Hello and welcome to volume 43, number 40 of Grapevine, your weekly local news magazine. Brought to you by the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association, this edition is published on Friday, the 6th of October, 2023. And in the news this week, the marketplace revamp raises more questions than answers. More controversy over new houses at Caister. A potential culture clash over next year's festivals. And Vision Norfolk benefits from the catwalk. Hi, I'm Andrew, your presenter and newsreader for the week. And also, I'll be catching up with the legend that is Malcolm Metcalfe as he reaches the summit of his 90 Before 90 charity challenge. Yes, all the details on your local news and events during the next hour. Firstly though, it's birthday time. And this week, we send our very best wishes out to Tony Balls, celebrating this coming Tuesday, the 10th of October. Have a great day, Tony. More details have emerged of the investigation into Great Yarmouth's market revamp. It has been revealed that an inquiry is underway into Yarmouth's multi-million pound regeneration project. It follows a councillor's claims it was due to a, and I'm reading this just as it's written, quote, £2.5 million cost due to a lack of signing a contract. Great Yarmouth Borough Council has since confirmed the investigation is to probe the reasons behind the escalating costs of the project, which it says has been caused by delays. A Great Yarmouth Borough Council spokesman said, the original market had reached the end of its life and there were increasing concerns over the structure, so the decision was taken to invest in a new covered market. There has been cost escalation for a number of well-documented reasons, including the need to widen the foundations, wind bracing design changes, and unexpected cabling. These all contributed towards delays impacting on cost. The council procured experts in their field to design and build the scheme and is now undertaking a review into the delays. Once the review is complete, members will receive a report. The council has said the market originally required the council to make a capital contribution of £2.1 million, which has just been increased by £450,000. It's just one of the many ambitious plans for the borough, Great Yarmouth Borough Council has said, which has been funded by more than £30 million secured through the government's Future High Street Fund, lottery funding and town deal. Councillor Michael Giel revealed the investigation at a scrutiny committee meeting on Thursday the 21st of September, when he questioned a positive report on the project despite the investigation that was underway. The market revamp has been taking shape since April 2021 and the first trade has moved in the following year. It was predicted that the final phase of the project would be completed by the end of this summer. Hundreds of people gathered to watch an extra special display as the country's first ever legacy lifeboat was escorted to her new Norfolk home by five vessels. The crowd lined the pier at Great Yarmouth and Goulston's RNLI station to welcome the arrival of the new RNLI lifeboat, a Shannon class RNLB 1344 named George and Francis Phelan. This is the nation's first legacy lifeboat, which includes the name of a person who has left a gift in their will to the RNLI on the side of the vessel. With the construction of this lifeboat being fully funded by a gift from Frances Phelan, who asked that the vessel be named after herself and her late husband, there were poignant scenes as five crew members sailed the new lifeboat home after a three-day passage from the RNLI headquarters in Poole in Dorset. The crew, led by coxswain Andy Mason and second coxswain and station mechanic Rod Wells, were met by five East Coast lifeboats and an HM Coast Guard rescue team just near Hopton. The lifeboats, including the John Rowntree from Great Yarmouth and Gorleston, the Samarbeta, also from Yarmouth and Gorleston, the Patsy Knight from Lowestoft, the Bernard Matthews II from Caister, and the Sea Weaver from Hemsby, then escorted the new Shannon-class lifeboat to her new home at Great Yarmouth and Gorleston Station during a special parade. The new lifeboat was put through her paces to demonstrate her manoeuvrability as large crowds watched on. With the pierheads crowded as the new boat arrived, the procession then lined up at the mouth of Gorleston Pier, where the boat was given a fire hose salute at 1:34 p.m. 10 minutes later, the new lifeboat entered Gorleston Harbour, crossing the pierheads to her new home at precisely 1344 to reflect the lifeboat fleet number that is on her side. All five lifeboats then moored up to celebrate the new vessel's arrival, with the station being open to the public. Rod Wells, the station mechanic and the volunteer coxswain, said, "It was wonderful to see everyone on the pier to welcome us home with our new boat. The crew of Great Yarmouth and Gorleston RNLI station were deeply moved by the massive welcome on the pier. We thank you all from the bottom of our hearts." Coxswain Andy Mason said, "It was fantastic to see our fellow East Coast lifeboats join us for the parade and celebration. It really made our homecoming extra special." With the RNLI's first legacy lifeboat proudly displaying the loved one's name on the side of the vessel, a replica board of all the names on the side of the George and Francis Phelan was also put up at the station for the public to see. Staying with the sea now, and ministers are being urged to stump up more money to protect Norfolk's crumbling coastline and to change how they allocate cash to take into account the impact erosion has on tourism. Leading councillors said the way the government currently calculates how much money areas get to tackle erosion means Norfolk does not get its fair share, at a time when people have lost their homes to collapsing cliffs. They say the formula used to award funding needs to better recognise how important tourism is to communities, rather than simply focusing cash on where the most homes are at risk. Conservative councillors criticised their own government and their own MPs for not doing enough to safeguard the county. A motion that the council should write to Environment Secretary Therese Coffey, who represents Suffolk Coastal, asking for changes, was agreed at a meeting of the full council and with cross-party support. It was tabled by James Bensley, Tory County Councillor for East Flegg. He said tourism needs to be recognised in the formula when the higher authorities are making decisions in where to help and where not to. "I realise we cannot have a blanket wall all the way along the Norfolk coast, but certain communities need a little bit more attention than others when you take tourism into consideration." Fellow Conservative Councillor Carl Smith, the leader of Great Yarmouth Borough Council, said he had seen the devastating impact of coastal erosion on communities such as at Hemsby, where people have lost their homes. High spring tides and gale force winds wreaked havoc in the coastal village earlier this year, with properties left precariously perched on the edge and having to be demolished. Mr. Smith said, "What we are asking for is the government to look at how they allocate the funding. They will allocate funding where there's a heavy density of people and properties, but what we're looking at, especially along the coast with tourism, is that the economy that that brings in. Hemsby alone brings in £80 million each year into the borough, of a total of £700 million that Great Yarmouth brings into the tourism economy." Mr. Smith said about £20 million would allow defences to be put in to protect Hemsby and the businesses based there. Stuart Clancy, Conservative Councillor for Taverham, said, "This motion is very, very important. It's important to Hemsby, it's important to Great Yarmouth, and it's important to Norfolk. MPs are the people not doing enough. We've got a situation where the unelected, unaccountable Quango, the Environment Agency, also aren't doing enough, and DEFRA, the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, aren't doing enough. Government consistently fails to address these issues, and managed retreat is not an option for Norfolk. We have to lobby our MPs hard. We have to make the Environment Agency work hard for us, and we need to make DEFRA work for us." The motion was backed by councillors from other political parties. Colin Walker, Labour councillor for Great Yarmouth Magdalen Division, said, "I look at what's happening in Hemsby in particular and it's heartbreaking." Liberal Democrat Lucy Shires, who represents North Walsham East, said, "Coastal communities felt abandoned by the government." For the Green Party, Catherine Rabbit, who represents West Deptwade, said her group supported the motion but questioned if the Conservatives fully grasped the extent of the threat to the county from rising sea levels. In reply, the government says it already provides a fair and consistent approach for allocating grants and that tourism was a consideration. DEFRA said North Norfolk was already getting extra protection after it was picked to benefit from a slice of a £36 million fund. A spokesman for DEFRA said, "We recognise the threat from climate change and sea level rise, which is why we're investing a record £5.2 billion over 6 years in flood and coastal erosion schemes to better protect thousands of properties." As part of the government's £200 million flood and coast innovation programme, £36 million is being invested to explore innovative approaches of adapting to the effects of coastal erosion through the Coastal Transition Accelerator programme, which will help support coastal communities, like those in North Norfolk, to prepare and plan for the long term in the face of a changing coastline. What's that old saying? Time and tide waits for no man. Well, let's hope we can get some action on this soon. The grieving father is publishing a children's book inspired by the stories he used to tell his late son. Tim Hills from Great Yarmouth came up with the tale Why Do Crabs Walk Sideways more than 20 years ago when his son Carl was a child. Mr. Hills, who's 60, said, "Carl used to always tell me to send the stories out and try to get them published, but I never did." Last year, Carl, who lived with his father in Cobham, died of an embolism related to COVID. He was just 28 years old. "He'd been complaining about one of his legs aching and he went to the doctor to get it checked," Mr. Hill said. "They arranged for him to have a blood test, but Carl caught COVID so he couldn't get the test. And he said that if his son had taken the test, the embolism might have been discovered." After his son's death, Mr. Hills was clearing out the spare room of their house when he found one of those old bedtime stories, which he'd typed up. He said, "I thought I owe it to Carl to at least try to get it published, so this really is for him." And the book will be published on October the 13th under the name Timmy Hilly. It's a picture book which tells the story of a colony of crabs that is being terrorised by a seagull named Simon. And Mr. Hills, who now lives in Lowestoft and works at the James Paget Hospital, started making up children's stories when Carl was around 6 years old. "I would borrow books from the library, but I would start elaborating on them, exaggerating some of the characters," he said. "Then I started writing a few just for him." "When the book is published, it will be tinged with sadness because Carl is not there to see it," he said. A survey is currently underway to assess the state of Great Yarmouth Borough Council's social housing, with hopes to visit every property in its portfolio. The results will then be used to determine the improvements needed and help provide a, quote, vision for the future to bring homes up to a higher standard. Mark Burns, head of community, said, "It is a challenging agenda, but this ambitious plan will provide a vision for the future. We know we can't do everything right now, but we will prioritise what is needed." Nicola Turner, head of housing, added, "The survey will help us know what's going on in our homes, and where we identify any houses that need urgent improvements, we will immediately report it to our asset team." The housing investment plan follows a damning report last year that laid bare the need for improvements in repairs and maintenance. The council has since agreed to take over the task of maintaining more than 5,000 social houses in the area from Great Yarmouth North. And this is expected to happen no later than September 2024. As councillors discussed the report at a scrutiny committee meeting, members called for more action to tackle the issue of damp and mould and suggested that an education programme was needed for tenants. Bernard Williamson, chair of the committee, highlighted that there have been complaints about the quality of service from residents, about the slow repair times. Trevor Wainwright, leader of the Labour opposition group, feared that whilst the report was ambitious, similar plans had failed to deliver, adding, "The proof is in the pudding." Further details of the action plan will be revealed in the coming weeks. Now, a pair of familiar voices from one of Norfolk's best-known holiday resorts is taking the podcast world by storm, giving fans a backstage look at the comings and goings of the park. Jack Jenkins and Henry Patterson, principal compares at Potter's Resort in Hopton-on-Sea, started the all-exclusive podcast as a side hobby to their day jobs. Amused by the daily antics of their colleagues at the holiday park, they wanted to lift the curtain on the challenges and quirks of working across Potter's Resorts in Hopton-on-Sea and Five Lakes in Essex. From banter about Mr. Jones' love of winter coats to Henry's bi-weekly splurges on posh London haircuts, the podcasters said their humorous approach has won them fans across the globe. Mr. Patterson said, "I've had countless conversations with Jack about his coat obsessions, shared my passion for a perfect omelette, and even delved into the quirkiest parts of Potter's Resorts." Through it all, the all-exclusive podcast truly showcases the spirit and fun that defines our team and this incredible place. That's just like Grapevine, then. And staying on an entertainment theme, a Halloween show in Great Yarmouth is promising spooky, silly laughs along with the thrills of the circus. The Hippodrome is busy planning for another edition of its spooktacular show, which is now in its 10th year and opens on October the 20th for the half term. The show sees comedy duo Jack Jay and Johnny Mac embark on a hilarious spooky journey to Dracula's castle for a Halloween night like no other. They'll be joined by a cast of circus acts, dancers and aerialists as they navigate through tombs, graveyards and plenty of ghosts along the way. It's set against an immersive, spooky backdrop that encompasses the Hippodrome Arena. Johnny Mac, who is now in his 14th year at the Hippodrome, said, "If you're looking to have fun this Halloween, then look no further. We've got a show full of spooky, silly laughs in an action-packed adventure. We can't wait." His co-host and producer, Jack Jay, said, "It's always a lot of fun to challenge ourselves in creating a different atmosphere in this amazing building with huge sets and props. And this year, it feels even bigger than ever. Audiences are really immersed in the action." Owner Peter Jay said he's been blown away by the response to ticket sales so far and is urging people to book early. "We've been so pleased with the response from our audiences. Since going on sale, our box office has been inundated with calls, and while there are still great seats left, tickets are selling out fast. So, these tickets can be booked by calling 01493 738 77 or through the box office or online at www.hippodromecircus.co.uk. And the show runs from October the 20th to the 31st, with tickets for adults ranging from £20 to £28 and for children from £13 to £8. A pub in Great Yarmouth Town Centre that was built using rubble from the Second World War has been sold at auction for £130,000. The Mariner's Tavern in Howard Street South went under the hammer on Thursday, September the 28th, with live bidding ending 48 hours later. The venue was auctioned by Clive Empson Auctioneers with a guide price between £150,000 and £160,000. The Mariner's opened in the 1830s, and was closed for the duration of the Second World War before reopening in 1951. The premises was then rebuilt in 1957 using rubble that remained after the war. It has occasionally hosted beer festivals and has been a regular in the Good Beer Guide for the last few years. In 2010, the pub bagged the Norfolk and Norwich Campaign for Real Ale, that's Camra, as Branch Pub Pub of the Year Award. Before the auction, Paul Bridgman, Regional Director of Clive Empson Auctioneers, said, "The freehold property arranged over two levels with a courtyard garden to the side is in need of some improvement, but it also offers a great opportunity to run a town centre pub business." And following on from last week's report about the Out There Festival, there's a little bit of a backlash after the festival has decided to move to the same weekend as another big event. This week, the organisers of the Out There Festival in Yarmouth announced the dates for next year's event that will be switched to the first weekend of June, when the town's comic convention, known as Comic Con, normally takes place. Since 2018, Comic Con has taken place at Great Yarmouth Racecourse over that June weekend, while Out There traditionally entertains crowds over 2 days in September. The organisers of Comic Con, Philip and Karen Wellsby, have expressed frustration over the move. While Out There have said it is an opportunity to work collaboratively, the decision has been slammed by businesses on Regent Road, who say moving the festival to June will damage the local economy. Both sides are meeting this week to discuss the matter. Mr. Wellsby said he first heard rumours that Out There were planning the switch some months ago. We contacted them and we asked them, please do not clash with ours, and that festivals shouldn't be in competition, they should work together, he said. But they heard nothing back. He said a privately funded festival like Comic Con cannot compete with a free event like Out There, which is funded by the Arts Council England and supported by both the Yarmouth Borough Council and the Norfolk County Council. Mr. Welby said both events should be able to run successfully in the town. There are enough weekends for all events to run in Yarmouth. It's just crazy they're putting theirs on the one weekend in the year when there's another big event in the town. This year's Comic Con brought 4,000 people to the town, while Out There brings in tens of thousands of people. Marcine Rodwell, Communications and Audience Development Manager of Out There Arts, said, as Great Yarmouth's cultural offer expands and grows due to the fantastic work the local organisers have put in, simultaneous events will be more common. We see this as a real opportunity to work collaboratively. He said they hope to work with Comic Con. Year on year, the Out There Festival brings in tens of thousands of people to the town and generates millions of pounds to the economy. Together, we can build on these achievements. But businesses along Regent Road disagree. Paul Platten, who runs the art and craft store Something Different, said, it's going to be very damaging to the local economy. When the Out There Festival was on last weekend, my takings were 25% up on the previous Saturday because of increased footfall. We need the festival in September, he added. Paul Wellier, who runs the T-Shirt King shop, echoed these comments. It's pointless moving it to that time of year when there are already plenty of people in the town, he said. It's for when the season is over, it brings people to the town. He also said it wasn't fair on the organisers of Comic Con, who put on a very good event every year. Belinda Plain, who works at Tickles, a costume shop, said she didn't agree with the decision. Why ruin two good things, she said. People come to the town for the Out There Festival and they stay for it. To put it on the same day as Comic Con, there's no thought gone into this. Shops need something in the latter part of the year. I do hope they reconsider, she added. Yeah, let's hope there's some form of compromise that can come out of this. As I mentioned at the start of the programme, Malcolm Metcalf from Goulston has undertaken this amazing challenge to complete 90 first-time events before he turns 90 in December. Now, you may remember I spoke with him for Grapevine a few months ago, and we learnt of his lifetime of travels and adventures around the world. To celebrate his upcoming 90th and raise more money for his beloved hospice charity, the latest leg of his challenge saw Malcolm travelling from Yarmouth to King's Lynn last Saturday via 15 different forms of transport. Well, I caught up with Malcolm at Acle after he'd ridden in a police car from his home in Goulston into Yarmouth, and then from Yarmouth in, as you will hear, a very throaty and a very powerful Ford Mustang. Malcolm, lovely to see you here in Acle on the first leg of this amazing journey.
Well, that's lovely to see you. Well, I was just started this morning, 8 o'clock, in a police car, came to the bus station in Yarmouth, and then I've just come up in this lovely, superb
Mustang.
Yep. Look at it.
Sitting there grumbling away.
Yeah, grumbling away. He says it's not running too well, but it ran lovely along there. And so now we're going to go in a chimney sweep van, to the Maidshead Hotel in Norwich.
Right.
There I'm going to get into a Bentley car. They're going to shuffle me to the Priscilla Bacon Hospice. And from there I go to a little place near Wyndham. I'm going to get in a big truck.
Yeah.
And from there I'm going to Dereham. And I'm going to get in a 1934 Wolseley car, and then I go a bit further and I get into an Elvis Presley Cadillac car.
Oh, wow.
Yes, and then I'm going on the back of a motorbike.
You love your bikes, don't you?
And then I come into Narborough.
Yeah.
I was going to be travelling on a horse and cart, but the horse has got lame, I think, so we got to change that.
Yeah.
Eventually, I should get to King's Lynn. And at King's Lynn, I'm going in a really special Formula One stock car.
Well, how's that going to work then? You're going to be a passenger in
I'm going to be a passenger.
Well,
yes, and I'm really honoured.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. I so gather I'm, this gentleman's come a long way for that.
Yeah, he's come all the way from York. It's a lady, actually.
It's a lady.
I didn't realise.
Even better.
It's a lady, yeah. A young lady. Yeah. I think she's only 20 years old. And we're going to go 5 laps around the this track.
Yeah, yeah.
There's going to be a crowd here of about 3,000 or 4,000.
Yeah, yeah.
Then they stock car.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Well, so I'm looking forward to all this.
I bet you are.
Yes, and my friend here, I've never met him before, but he's come all the way from Linton in Cambridge.
Yeah.
And he's going to film a video all this right the way through.
Fantastic.
Aren't I lucky?
Oh, fantastic.
Yes.
And we've got a beautiful day for us.
Yes,
couldn't
we have.
Asked for more.
Couldn't, no.
Well, yes. On behalf of everyone at Grapevine, I'm going to wish you well.
Well, thank you.
You are an amazing man.
Well, lovely to see you.
Good luck.
Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Malcolm.
So,
he's great, isn't he? And he always has this great big beaming smile. Well, I'm pleased to report the day went superbly for him. He especially enjoyed his ride in the old Elvis Cadillac. Apparently, it had been owned by Elvis. So, Malcolm was really thrilled that he'd actually sat in the seat that that the King sat in. And he said that the stock car that rocketed him around King's Lynn Stadium for 5 laps was thrilling, even though it took about 5 men to get him out of it, he said, which didn't look very graceful. But the sun shone for him, the day went superbly, and he actually completed his 90 challenges during that day. But of course he's not stopping there, is he? No, he told me that he has a book signing in October in Norwich, and on the 21st of October, he'll be at Carrow Road to present the match ball before Norwich City's game against Leeds. Knowing Malcolm, I wouldn't put it past him to come off the bench and score the winner either. Well, I'm sure we'll be hearing about this amazing man soon. Now, as Malcolm's a big fan of all things American, I thought this little piece of music might be good for it. And knowing him, he's probably been to all those places as well. The Rolling Stones there in Route 66. Right, let's get back to little old Norfolk now. Here's the second part of the news. And a controversial development set to create 665 homes in a coastal village has moved a step closer to starting. Persimmon Homes has made a planning application for the first phase of 180 homes on land at Nova Scotia Farm in Caister. It has revealed the layout and design of the buildings, which are to be built on the 83-acre site. But fears remain that the scheme will lead to the destruction of Wildlife Haven hedgerows on the site. The development was approved at a heated meeting in July last year, despite several objections from local people. They worried about overdevelopment and the impact on the road network, the environment, schools and local healthcare services, as well as the sewerage system. Kevin Wood of Caister Parish Council remains worried. He said, "We still have extreme concerns due to the objection of hedgerows and trees on and around the site." At a meeting last month, the developers said they would save some of the hedgerow, but we still worry about the impact this will have. The first phase of the development hopes to build 180 homes, with 142 available on the open market, ranging from one bedroom to five bedroom houses, and 38 properties available for affordable renting. As well as housing, the scheme will also create some outdoor open spaces for the new community, including a pond area at the edge of the settlement. The developers believe the project will provide long-term ecological enhancements and employment opportunities through the development's construction. It will also go some way towards meeting the Great Yarmouth Borough's housing need, with more than 7,000 homes to be built. The public has the opportunity to comment on the plans via the council's website, with the decision due on November the 1st. A spokesman for Persimmon Homes Anglia said, "We want to preserve as much of the hedgerow along Jack Chase Way as possible to protect the wildlife that inhabits it, whilst balancing the safety of road users. We've been working with the Highways Authority to devise a plan to retain a longer stretch of the hedgerow, and we are currently awaiting a decision from Norfolk County Council on our proposal." A man was left unconscious in a pool of blood after New Year celebrations at a caravan park descended into violence. Shane Stevens, aged 52, repeatedly punched another resident during a violent dispute, causing him to fall from a balcony. Frank Trott was knocked out and was hospitalised with head injuries after the incident at Bellaire Holiday Park at Hemsby in the early hours of New Year's Day 2020. Another park resident, Lucy Osborne, who was trying to help Mr. Trott before paramedics arrived, was also threatened and grabbed by the throat. Stevens of High Street in Stetchworth near Bury St Edmunds was found guilty of causing actual bodily harm, assault and criminal damage following a trial in his absence at Norwich Magistrates Court. Paul Roach, prosecuting, said the accused had launched the attack in a confrontation over previous disputes between himself and other residents, including one over the closing of a caravan window to prevent burglars. Giving evidence, Mr. Trott said he had been punched to the head before falling when a veranda gave way, causing him to fall and hit his head on the concrete below. Miss Osborne told magistrates Stevens had been, quote, ranting, raving and swearing when he confronted her as she attempted to put the unconscious Mr. Trott in the recovery position. "He put his hands round my throat and pushed me," she said. "He was really aggressive and angry the whole time." Stevens had shown no remorse after telling police he'd been acting in self-defence when Mr. Trott had gained his injuries, the court heard. Finding him guilty, magistrates said they found the witnesses very credible and his actions did not amount to self-defence. They had earlier denied a defence application for the trial to be adjourned, saying medical evidence for his absence was not compelling. Stevens will be sentenced at Kingsland Magistrates Court on October the 4th. And areas where people are most at risk of falling the victim to crime have been revealed by a list of Norfolk's most dangerous neighbourhoods. Great Yarmouth had the highest overall crime rate in the county in 2022, with 106 crimes per 1,000 people. King's Lynn and Norwich are next most dangerous, according to data provided by crimerate.co.uk. Perhaps unsurprisingly, given that it takes in much of the city centre and nightlife district, City Centre East in Norwich has the highest overall crime rate in the county, with nearly 3,000 offences in 2022, which is 435 per 1,000 inhabitants. Next most dangerous is the equally busy neighbouring City Centre West, with 4,279 offences, equating to 386 per 1,000 people. However, outside of Norwich's city centre, the areas with three neighbourhoods with the highest crime rates are all in Great Yarmouth. The bulk of the 8,747 offences recorded in our seaside town last year were in an area known as Yarmouth Parade, which includes much of the seafront and the surrounding streets, Yarmouth Central and Northgate and Southtown and Cobham. The most common crimes were violence, which includes crimes like domestic violence, followed by antisocial behaviour, public order, theft and criminal damage. The Yarmouth Parade area saw 2,839 offences, which is a crime rate of 292 per 1,000 people. Elsewhere in Norwich, the highest crime rates outside the city centre were seen at Lakenham and Tuxwood, Heartsease and Pilling Park and Mile Cross. At the other end of the scale, the likelihood of falling victim to crime, the safest neighbourhood in Norfolk is revealed as Taverham, with 30 offences per 1,000 people, followed by Thorpe St Andrew, Sproston, Wotton and, I'm pleased to say, Bradwell and Caister-on-Sea. So let's have some good news now. And this is a story about our good friends at Vision Norfolk. A sellout charity fashion show has raised over £1,500 for Norfolk's sight loss charity, having featured a blind model on the catwalk, complete with her guide dog. Chet Valley Vineyard in Bergapton hosted over 50 fashion lovers at their winery for the event, which showcased clothes from French fashion brand Allura and was raising funds for Vision Norfolk. Among the amateur models taking to the catwalk was Lana Hempsel, who retains only around 1% of her sight, having been affected by Stargardt's disease in her teenage years. Lana was joined on the catwalk by her Labrador retriever Zorin, who's been her guide dog for the past 5 years. When I was 14, I thought becoming a model would solve all my problems and let me enjoy a glamorous life of fashion and travel, said Lana, who is also Deputy Cabinet Member for Highways, Infrastructure and Transport at Norfolk County Council. It's taken me a long time to achieve that ambition of taking to the catwalk, though. I had a slight anxiety about how Zorin would manage. It was a very alien environment for him, but he coped really well. I'm thrilled that the event raised so much money for Vision Norfolk. I'm really touched that so many people feel that supporting people with sight loss and their families is important. Bridget Hammond, who runs Chet Valley Vineyard with her husband John and is also a consultant ophthalmologist and oculoplastic surgeon, was another of the amateur models. Mrs. Hammond is a trustee of Vision Norfolk. The fashion show is part of a programme of events run by Chet Valley Vineyard in its winery and tasting rooms and outdoor wine meadow. The next event will be a Friday Fizz and Pizza on Friday, October the 20th. Full details of all the events at the Vineyard can be found at www.chetvineyard.co.uk. Carrying on with the good news, and our wheelchair star, Alfie Hewitt, has received a royal accolade at Windsor Castle for helping to put Norfolk on the sporting map. Alfie, who's 25 and from Cantley, was made an OBE for his services to tennis in King Charles I's birthday honours list on Tuesday, when he and his doubles partner, Gordon Reid, met the Princess Royal at Windsor Castle, where the Norfolk sports star was given his medal. The Norfolk tennis ace has achieved massive success on the court. With Gordon Reid, he has secured 18 wheelchair tennis doubles Grand Slam titles, with their latest coming at Wimbledon in July, where the duo beat the world's number one Takito Oda and partner Takui Maki. As a solo player, Alfie has won 8 Grand Slam singles titles throughout his career, with the most recent being his against his doubles partner Gordon at the US Open in September. Following the birthday honours list publication earlier this year, he said, I never would have dreamt I'd receive something like this in my lifetime. I just get my head down and work hard in the sport that I love. I'm extremely proud and grateful for this and to everyone who's helped me get to where I am today. The tennis ace said it was amazing to see wheelchair tennis and disability sport get this level of recognition. And the acknowledgement was vital in encouraging a more inclusive culture in sport and society. After turning pro in 2015, Alfie was crowned the youngest ever singles master champion just 2 years later, and again in 2021, when he also won the doubles title. He still lives in Norfolk and trains at David Lloyd's and Eastern College in Norwich. He and Gordon Reid were joined by Paralympians Laura Fasci and her husband Neil, who are both visually impaired, in receiving their OBE insignias at Windsor Castle. A husband and wife duo bringing the tastes of Malaysia to Galston with the launch of a new cafe. Marco Lai and Novi Lai, who own the Bamboo Gardens Takeaway in Church Road, are now launching a new venue in Lowestoft Road. Four Seasons will cater to the local student and working population with lunchbox-style dishes and early dinners. Having identified a gap in the local area, they will also be the first bubble tea outlet in Galston, which comes after the encouragement of their children, Harry and Crystal. Now, here's a look at a couple of planning issues that maybe haven't gone quite to plan. A man's bid to knock down a dangerous chimney has gone up in smoke after a thumbs down from planners. Great Yarmouth Borough Council has refused an application by Rory McGrath to remove a chimney stack from a prominent Georgian house on White Street in Martham. The bid was retrospective, as the chimney was already taken down in April last year. In an email to a planning officer written in February this year, Mr. McGrath said the work was, quote, not carried out by choice, but was undertaken because we were advised that to leave the stack in a position was dangerous as it could collapse into the house. He would like to replace the stack, he said, but that could cost up to £10,000. Instead, Mr. McGrath applied for planning permission to prevent him having to replace the chimney stack and to cover the hole in the roof with slates. Originally, there were two chimney stacks on the house, which is a historic red brick Georgian property located in a conservation area. In a report published last month, planners said the chimneys had created a balanced look to the house and a point of interest in the roofscape of the immediate area. The removal of the chimney, quote, created an unbalanced look to the property, which is detrimental to the overall proportion of the building, they said. An engineer's report said there was a risk from strong winds and that urgent repairs were necessary, but did not advise the whole chimney needed to be removed. In a statement, the Borough Council said, applicants looking to make any development are always encouraged to discuss it with the council first. When it is clear that work has been carried out without permission, it can result in a formal planning enforcement action if the work is deemed unacceptable. As soon as the council are aware that regulations have been breached, contact will be made with the person responsible to resolve the situation. Well, hopefully we'll hear some more on that in due course. Now, this planning application and work is in the city, but I have to say, I think it makes for interesting listening, especially if your name's Victor Meldrew. The controversial £4.4 million revamp of one of Norwich's busiest roundabouts has descended into farce, critics have claimed. The project at Heartsease has become embroiled in a bitter political row after council leaders admitted they cannot do some of the work planned because they do not know who owns the land. Now they have also conceded that some proposed elements, including a segregated cycle path, might have to be ditched altogether if the council cannot secure the land. The project has already provoked anger among some locals, who say the plans are overly complicated and could create more congestion. They have also criticised the impact of the roadworks and fear the latest wrangles could delay the scheme. Alison Birmingham, Labour County Council for Crome Division, said, this adds a new layer of risk and uncertainty if there is a delay in securing the land. for the local businesses that are already feeling the strain. She said, I've heard it called a farce and a fiasco. Call it what you like, but this is no way to treat people, businesses or public money. The council started 8 months of work on the revamp of Heartsease Roundabout last month, only for it to emerge that the authority does not own two required patches of land on either side of Harvey Lane. A process has started which would enable County Hall to force landowners to sell the land, which is outside the former Lloyds Bank building and the Heartsease pub. But the leaders have admitted they cannot do any work on that land until it has been bought, and they still do not know who actually owns the land. The council insists the scheme will not be delayed, with the need to purchase the land factored into the 8 month timescale. But the authority conceded if it cannot buy the land proposed, the segregated cycle lanes would have to be scrapped. Graham Plant, the council's cabinet member for Highways, Infrastructure and Transport, said, these are very small areas of land that do not compromise the delivery of the majority of the works. Work is not taking place on the areas of land which are still subject to acquisition, and work will only take place on such areas once the land is vested in the County Council. The process is underway and is expected to be completed in time for when the construction phase of that part of the junction is reached later. But the council confirmed if land cannot be obtained, it might not be able to provide a segregated cycle footpath. That means a segregated cycleway and footpath, doesn't it? Proposed as an addition to the original scheme. You couldn't make it up, could you?
Right, said Fred, both of us together, one each end and steady as we go. Tried to shift it, couldn't even lift it, we was getting nowhere, and so we had a cup of tea. And right, said Fred, give a shout for Charlie, up comes Charlie from the floor below. After straining, heaving and complaining, we was getting nowhere, and so we had a cup of tea. And Charlie had a think, and he thought we ought to take off all the handles and the things what held the candles, but it did no good. Well, I never thought it would. All right, said Fred, have to take the feet off to get them feet off, wouldn't take a mo. Took its feet off, even took the seat off, should have got us somewhere, but no. So Fred said, let's have another cup of tea, and we said, righto. All right, said Fred, have to take the door off, need more space to shift the so-and-so. Had bad twinges, taking off the inches, and it got us nowhere, and so we had a cup of tea. And right, said Fred, have to take the wall down, that there wall is gonna have to go. Took the wall down, even with it all down, we was getting nowhere, and so we had a cup of tea. And Charlie had a think, and he said, look Fred, I've got a sort of feeling, if we remove the ceiling with a rope or two, we could drop the bladder through. All right, said Fred, climbing up a ladder with his crowbar, gave a mighty blow. Was he in trouble? Half a ton of rubble landed on the top of his dome. So Charlie and me had another cup of tea, and then we went home. I said to Charlie, we'll just have to leave it standing on the landing, that's all. You see, the trouble with Fred is he's too hasty. Now you never get nowhere if you're too hasty. Digging his hole in the ground, so big and sort of round it was, and there was I digging it deep. It was flat at the bottom and the sides were steep. When along comes this bloke in a bowler, which he lifted and scratched his head. Whoa, he looked down the hole, poor demented soul, and he said, do you mind if I make a suggestion? Don't dig it there, dig it elsewhere. You're digging it round and it ought to be square. The shape of it's wrong, it's much too long, and you can't put a hole where a hole don't belong. I ask, what a liberty, eh? Nearly bashing right in the bowler. Well, there was I, a sturdy me-o, shoveling earth for all that I was worth. I was, and there was him, standing up there so grand and official with his nose in the air. So I gave him a look sort of sideways and I leaned on me shovel and sighed. Whoa, I lit me a fag and having took a drag, I replied, I just couldn't bear to dig it elsewhere. I'm digging it round cause I don't want it square, and if you disagree it doesn't bother me. That's the place where the O's gonna be. Well, there we were discussing this hole in the ground, so big and sort of round it was, it's not there now. The ground's all flat and beneath it is the bloke in the bowler hat. And that's that.
To finish up with this week, I've got a really interesting piece here from the Civic Society, written once again by Mr. Hugh Sturziker, and it's about the Toll House Museum. And it goes like this. The Toll House Museum in Toll House Street has a fascinating history, having been built around 1150 as a merchant's house. It is built of flint and ashlar. Ashlar is where the stones are cut to a uniform shape with very little mortar between them. And it has a tiled roof. It is a Grade 1 listed building and is one of the oldest civic buildings in the country. In the 13th century, it was the toll house for herring, which were landed on South Quay. In 1261, Henry II granted permission for the basement to be used as a jail. The prisoners were mainly pirates and local thieves and had to pay a jail fee right through until 1832, would you believe? In the 18th century, hard labour consisted of working a treadmill. The jail was closed in 1836, after which the basement was used for storage. The toll house was bought by the local authority in 1552, and the last council session was held there in 1832. The building was used as a courtroom and a police station, and in 1885 it became a museum, which continues to this day, of course, being run by the Norfolk Museum Service. During the Second World War, the toll house was bombed on April 8, 1941, and again on June 25, 1942, the same day that St Nicholas Church, the Minster, was firebombed. Fortunately, it was decided to rebuild the toll house and it was reopened on the 24th of June 1960. Going back again in history, in 1645, the toll house was the place for the infamous Matthew Hopkins, the self-styled witchfinder general, to give evidence against women who had been accused of witchcraft. He had been born around 1620, the son of a Puritan minister in Great Wenham in Suffolk, and in a period of 3 years, he and his colleague John Stern sent more people to be hanged for witchcraft than in all the rest of England. They covered mainly East Anglia, and they drew up their own rules of what qualified someone to be called a witch, and charged the local authorities for finding witches in their area. He died about the age of 25 with what was thought to be pulmonary tuberculosis. A far more pleasant person associated with the toll house was Sarah Martin, who was born in Great Yarmouth in 1791. She was orphaned at a young age and brought up in Caister by her grandmother, who was a glove maker. At the age of 14, Sarah was apprenticed to a dressmaker. On Mondays, she provided education for children in the workhouse infirmary until 1838, when a master and schoolmistress were appointed following the building of the new workhouse. She then taught factory girls in St Nicholas Church. She began visiting the Toll House Jail in 1818, reading the Bible to prisoners. Later, she held services on Sundays to encourage the prisoners to improve their lives. She also taught them to read and write and to make spoons and books which they could sell. And she died in 1843. The Toll House Museum is well worth a visit, although it is open only in school holidays. However, it is also available for private hire, private functions and weddings. The next meeting of the Civic Society will be on Tuesday, October the 10th at 7:30, when Lord Somerleyton will talk about the changes being made to his estate and the rewilding in other parts of the country. The meeting will be held at Christchurch in King Street and is free to members and students. Otherwise, admission is £2, or the annual membership for the Civic Society is £10. For any more information, please visit www.civicsocietygy.co.uk. Well, that's it for this week's recording, which is copyright 2023 of the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association. News content is adapted mainly from the Great Yarmouth Mercury. However, the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association accept responsibility for editorial decisions made for this recording. If you need to contact us, you can do so via our website at grapevinegy.org or telephone us on 07947 946 493, where you can access our regularly checked answering service. I hope you've enjoyed this week's recording, and next week your newsreader will be Margaret. So we look forward to welcoming you then for much more of your local news. In the meantime, from all of us at Grapevine, stay safe, stay well, and bye for now. Bye.